Professor Lauren Jobs, Managed Care Class, 111808, Podcast 1, Room 205.
That was Jordan Laughs.
Just to let you guys know, this is recording.
Oh.
You never know. Some people might. Say.
No.
What?
Sign sheet that we used the one from last week. Yes, sign in.
You said use it again? Or?
Yeah, use it again. You see where it says sign in there?
Oh, yeah, just sign in.
I don't know, that's why I don't know what to expect.
Yeah, I really don't know either. Thank you.
Oh, with the outline? Yeah, you could have put it into the space where they show up. Very often the overall questions are drawn on something that's happening, although what's exactly in the article is not necessarily
okay.
The substance of it.
Okay.
Save that article for you for a while. Thank you.
I just end up the cover sheet.
Previous years on the draft, but still the conclusion and the introduction is still the hardest part to write correctly. And what's more, getting the title correct can be difficult. Putting it in a question. And then, of course, these are supposedly balanced papers. They're erudite papers looking at both sides of the issue and avoiding certain terms like certainly, clearly, surely, obviously, or making too much of an argument on one side or the other. Erudite papers are more balanced and more academic. So these papers are not briefs, but rather are to be considered journal entries, really. You would try to write an article for the journals. And indeed, some of the papers will turn out to be worthy of consideration by journals. So you can resubmit as many drafts as you wish before the due date.
Any questions
about the paper? I don't know.
The spacing and the
endnotes
that I'm
printing
out, are you, like, is there a certain format that you
should do? No. You know, just don't do anything unusual in terms of spacing too far apart or too big letters, in order to arrive at 20 pages. But other than that, I don't really care. The footnote should follow some sort of logic, but I don't care if it's a rule book or not. Vanessa? Either one. Footnotes are easier for me, but endnotes are just as good. Just saves me a lot of turning pages. When you submit the final draft, please submit it in electronic form, because give it to me in electronic form, right, so I can submit it that way. You know what Turnitin is? Anyone know what Turnitin is?
No.
Turnitin is a service where you can submit a document, a student's document, or actually anyone's document, and it'll look for similar wording or other documents or similar wording from journal articles or whatever. It has a huge data bank. And a lot of the papers turn up similarities and a lot of turn up actual wording. But then if you go back to the paper, there, it's a quote, as it should be a quote. Other than that, it's also a way that prevents, in general, students from using other students' papers, right? Or even the papers that they themselves have turned in already someplace else with the same wording. And it's pretty good. It has a threshold that's pretty high in terms of similar wording, but it does a good job. I haven't found any irregularities in these years of papers that I've taken as attorney. So it's a good service. Apparently it's free. I don't know if the university pays for it or not. Okay. So last week, among other things, we had a nice discussion about whether or not managed law should be, promoted or not. We found that the ADA was seemingly encouraging it. They had a website and whatever. And we discovered the pros and cons of managed law, and they were similar to the pros and cons of discussion on managed care. The question I promised to answer is, should you be worried? Will managed law become the dominant mode of practicing law, and will it limit your incomes, as has happened in medicine, and limit your range of action? So were you surprised, first of all, to find that managed law, meaning prepaid legal services, you know, only in this class is the term managed law used? That's not a term that you'll find used, but the term is prepaid legal services. And the question is, when you start looking this up, were you surprised to find how prevalent it was and how many sites and the organizations involved in it? Were you surprised? Or did you pretty much know that it existed? How many people were surprised? How many people were not surprised, knew it existed? Okay. So now I'll answer the question whether it's going to be important or not, but I'm interested in knowing what you think. Do you think, how many people feel that managed law will become more prominent, much more prominent in the future and affect your practices? How many people feel that way? And how many people are worried about it at all? How many people are worried about it just a little bit? Not really. So, I mean, you're not worried. Why are you not worried?
Once I said that it has been around for like 30 years and only recently broke the 5 million mark. So that it wasn't just like a new advent.
It is true, and especially some prepaid legal services through unions and organizations that are around a long time. But the issue, of course, is that the contract that these plans have with attorneys, the agreement that the attorneys are willing to operate under, which makes it similar to managed care. Well, I don't think you have to worry. I don't think you have to worry. Why? First of all, are these plans comprehensive? Do they take care of all necessary legal services? Is there such a doctrine as, you know, medical necessity? Is there a legal necessity that you can define? Not really. Why? Because a lot of legal services are optional. How many houses you buy, how many business arrangements you get into. Some of the things that they cover are things that you could say are needed by everyone, generally speaking. A will, a phone consultation, But the definition of legal necessity is far from being able to be established in a way that an insurance company could cover an event. It's far too much that's voluntary. That's number one. Number two, they cover court costs. No, they cover third-party costs. No, they just cover the services of that attorney. Right? So in medicine, that's quite different, because medicine, a big portion of it is covering for services that doctors order. Labs, x-rays, hospitalization, medicines. Managed care covers that. And if a physician doesn't participate in the plan, patients generally can't get those things covered. So that aspect of it is that, you know, that hook to get attorneys to come in and say, well, you know, well, counselor, you know, if you don't sign up with us, then how's your patient going to pay the $50,000 court bill? They're not covering the $50,000 or the expert witness or anything like that. Their coverage is very limited on these plans. And also, as far as what they're offering in terms of reduced fee, the attorney agrees to provide service at $75 an hour, which is really a reduced fee. Compared to normal fees that attorneys charge, it's quite a reduced fee. Very similar to the fees to that disparity of fees between non-managed care physicians' fee and managed care physicians' fee. But because it doesn't cover everything, it only covers a small amount. The issue there is that attorneys might sign up just to get the patients on the rolls. Because there's a lot of other things that attorney may provide service for other than what's covered, because what's covered is relatively small. It's almost like the ad, you know, the consultation is free. Right? You've been injured, call us. The consultation is free. It's a similar reason why some attorneys might want to sign up for these plans. It increases the role of the attorney's clients. And then the third thing, above all, I think, is that attorneys have the keys to the courthouse or the keys to the legislature far more than physicians do. A far greater number of legislators are attorneys and sympathetic to attorneys' practices than are physicians. A physician is a rarity in a legislative body, although less of a rarity nowadays, and with some notable exceptions, such as Palestine and others. So, in short, managed law is not going to be a threat to you as it was to physicians. But it is a good example of to get you to understand, well, kind of on your home turf, what this managed care might mean for the practice of a profession. Okay. For your information, this lecture is being podcast. It's being recorded as we speak. Okay, so we're going to You have the handout. We're just going to run through the review of last week. Articles discussed, why is healthcare industry slow to adopt information technology? The expenses, but we discussed that data entry by physicians is extremely difficult. Why are premiums so low, as low as $150 a month in the Cover Florida program? Is that the subsidy is great? No, it's just that they don't cover very much. And likewise, the minimum standards for health coverage under the Massachusetts Commonwealth Insurance Connector Authority, you know, what are they? Well, you know, they're fairly limited. It's not high-end catastrophic insurance. What are the difficulties encountered in the individual health care policy market? Well, similar, is that the benefits can be misleading, as well as the price can be very high. It's not as well regulated as the ERISA market. The Arizona Proposition 101 attempted to say that healthcare insurance cannot be mandated. It did not pass. I gave you an article with how close it was for your information. I gave you an article today. Do patients generally use comparative healthcare quality information? No, very rarely, even though it's become more and more available. Are Florida's Medicaid patients required to receive care through managed care plans? Not all of them, only 25 counties. I don't think that's all of Florida. But the managed care plans in many states are still on demonstration projects. Not New York. New York has them. Why are health insurers starting their own banks? This is a good one. You should have gotten your attention that article, right, when we discussed it last week. Health insurance companies going to operate as banks? Why? Right, they're going to have all this money coming in. The health savings accounts will be like brokerage houses, banks, that they'll be able to deposit and manage the money. But in the process of applying for it, what they said was very revealing. Hey, we're more of a financial institution than a healthcare institution anyway. Which, as we said, is true that managed care organizations really pay for the care and try to limit the cost of the care, but up until recently have really not been effective in the quality of care, or for that matter, in the amount of care. Will there be a shortage of blood physicians in the next decade, according to most articles? Well, hospitals starting a medical school, so they're planning on there being a shortage. And there probably is a shortage right now. How many physicians in the United States have concierge practices, according to the article? 260, not a lot. I think that's wrong because, you know, here and there I hear people going into concierge practices. I'm not sure where they got that number from. Only 260 practices in the United States seems like a very low number compared to what I think is reality. Only 200. How many physicians in the United States? 700,000. It's 200 and some physicians per million people. 300 million 700,000 just divide by 300 million people, 700,000 physicians. How many physicians is that per million people? Divide by 300. Per million people. $428 per million. But it should be the other way. It should be 700,000 divided by 3 million. That's the ratio. How many per? So it's 700,000 or 300 million. So it's 700,000 divided by 300 million. We want to find how many per million. So it's 3 per 2,333 per million. How many physicians per person? Or how many people? How many people per physician? I'm spending time with it because, you know, there's times that sometimes you have to make sense out of it. Like we did using 300 million per person, so let's figure out how many people per physician. There's 300 million. 300 million, and you would divide that by 700,000 physicians. 300 million divided by 7,000 per. So let's do it the other way. What was your number? 428 people per physician. Yeah, 428 people per physician. 2,000
2,000 per million.
That's a better number, I think, to hold in your head. So about 400 people per physician. For every 400 people or so, there's one physician. All specialties. Okay. Why could the forthcoming U.S. Supreme Court decision in Wyeth v. Levine be far-reaching? Because if state tort action against pharmaceutical companies is precluded by FDA approval of the the drug label inserts, then actions against pharmaceutical companies on torts liability will be pretty much eliminated. And do many physicians routinely prescribe placebos? Perhaps. Determining medical necessity. What is a QALY? Quality adjusted life year. Should cost no more than $50,000. And then we went over figuring out the learned hand formula as you might apply it to the duty to prevent, as you might apply it to the duty to cover something of medical care by an insurance company. You know, that was not an insurance doctrine, but we can use it as such, saying that reasonable action by an insurance company or by society would be that if the burden of preventing something was less than the cost of the event, then there's a duty arises to prevent that event. And for that, we have to say that all medical care is essentially preventative, even if there's a diagnosis. Even if someone comes into the hospital being treated by a heart attack, what you do there is preventative. You're preventing permanent damage to the heart, you're preventing death from cardiac arrest. So it's easier to call all medical care preventative. It's harder to say what kind of medical care should we say is prevention only, meaning that there's no diagnosis. We're just looking for something when nothing has occurred. That's a harder differentiation. I think it's much easier to say it's all preventative. However, some insurance companies will not cover something unless there's a diagnosis for which you are treating. And they say they don't cover preventative care. They say, well, you went to the doctor for a checkup, but you didn't go because anything was wrong, so that's preventative. Well, yeah, that's preventative, but if you went because something was wrong, you went to prevent further harm. Okay, any questions on any of that? We're going to apply this QALY to something later. Okay. We have, this is our next to the last lecture. We have only one more class, because what would have been our last class after Thanksgiving is preempted by a schedule change. It's either a Wednesday or a Monday, depending on this morning or this day or night. So here's what we still have to discuss, and which we will discuss it all today, because next week, I'm going to go over the exam with you. That exam that I gave you, I guess I'll bring more copies of it. But we'll go over the model answer to that exam. So one of the things you should do is try to answer it on your own this week. If you don't have it, email me. I'll email it to you. So it'd be good if you try to answer it on your own so that you can see how we might answer it the same or different in the class. Then I'll go over test taking in general in law school and for the bar, which is similar. And then I will give a comprehensive review and put everything together, try to wrap it up into one neat package from beginning to end, make it coherent. So that's next week. But today we still have to do organizations and contracting, contracts, healthcare. We still have to do fraud and abuse, And something I want to touch on that you're not going to read about, I'm not asking you to read about, is antitrust. And we will, if we still have time, catch up again on the articles. So on organizations and contracts, medical care has gotten complicated, as we said the first day, because there are a lot more people involved, a lot more organizations involved than there used to be. And it's all these relationships between providers and insurance companies and hospitals and medical groups and organizations of doctors that cause full employment for healthcare attorneys. It's those kind of relationships that has been a real boon to healthcare attorneys. It's a burgeoning and remains a burgeoning field. It's unlikely that the needs will change for healthcare attorneys, even if there becomes a single payer system in the country. But anyway, starting at age 74. Putnam v. MetLife, even if a contract doesn't say so, a managed care company is deemed to have a fair procedure to remove a doctor from the panel. Many states have passed specific statutes, including New York. There's a said you can't remove a doctor from a panel without cause, without a hearing. You can't do it summarily. And there has to be a reason. But there's a secret here that the book doesn't touch on, and that is it doesn't matter that a physician's contract with a managed care company is renewable from time to time, very often yearly. And none of the laws address the idea that, at the end of the contract, the managed care company does not have to renew the contract. That's the power of managed care. Managed care can choose the renderers of care whom they heal. That's their the big stick. Doc, if you don't give us the lowest price, we get a lower price elsewhere. That's what we're going to do. And that was much more prominent when managed care was growing. When a managed care organization said, we'll take a few doctors and no more. It's changed greatly since the early days of managed care, when someone would come to doctor's office and say, Doc, you sign with someone down the street, all your patients are going to go down the street. We have a lot of patients who are subscribers. It was even more operative out west when there's a very few managed care plans had almost all the patients. But it's changed now, so that when you think about it, it's managed care plans are trying now to get as many physicians to join up as they can. It's very rare for a managed care plan now to get an application from a physician and say, no, we're not going to take you. Except a fee schedule and board certified or whatever. Sure. It's to the managed care company's advantage to have a large number of physicians. Sometimes patients choose a managed care company based on whether their physician is in that plan or not. So what happened at first is very much different from what happens now. The argument at first was very strong that our power to keep these prices down, and you know how important that is for our society and for survival of this country. is our ability to contract with some doctors and not with others. So, yes, if we sign a contract for a year, state, go ahead and tell us that if we're going to remove the doctor, we have to do it for cause. But other than that, at the end of the year, it's a new contract, and we are, you know, free to contract with whom we want, barring the states that pass any willing provider law. There are a few states, not many, that say managed care company, insurance company, if you have a fee schedule, then any physician, any provider, vendor of care willing to accept that fee, you have to. You have to accept. In those states, fair process to remove a physician is necessary under those laws. And you have to say, not this physician. That's an exception to any willing provider. Statute of the state, that there's a reason why we're not going to take this physician and sign that physician year after year after year after year. But that's very few states, not New York. So all these hearings and all laws are fine, but if a managed care company were to wish to not contract with a physician when the term of the contract rolls around, that would be a short circuit to any of these rules. This Baylin versus SBL Health is a peculiar case in that it's argued on whether or not something called a health plan is involved in the corporate practice of medicine, and whether a restrictive covenant between a physician and this corporation was enforceable because it was restricting the physician's practice of medicine outside a 50-mile radius if the physician left. But it's hardly a distinction between what was a hospital and what was this corporation. The holding was that this is a hospital. A hospital has a license to operate as a hospital. It can't do so without the services, physicians. And so courts say, well, how do you draw the line between what is a corporate practice of medicine and not, and upheld the restrictive covenant. The term integration in healthcare means a whole lot different than it does in the rest of society. Integration healthcare means that physicians or organizations get together in a number of ways in order to deliver health care, in order to deliver the health care. There can be horizontal integration. A bunch of ophthalmologists get together and say, we'll practice as a group in some way or another. We'll be a IPO, integrated independent physician organization. We will contract with managed care to carve out the ophthalmology care for this group. But we are horizontally integrated, and we're all ophthalmologists. Then there's vertical integration, which is just the opposite. All specialties, all services, hospital, physicians even, vertical integration. Oh, we're a group, and we'll contract with managed care organizations, or even become a managed care organization ourselves, offer risk contracts. There is an assumption, but not a necessity, that these integrated delivery systems accept risk of some sort or another. it's not really necessary that for that to be called vertically or horizontally integrated, whether they accept risk or not. What is risk? Essentially, risk is accepting some sort of a capitated contract, meaning that for a fee, the integrated system agrees to provide a certain set of services. If there is risk, the integrated system is in the shoes of the managed care company. They're assuming some of the managed care risks by taking capitated contracts. And there was a big push for the actual renderer of care to be paid on a capitated basis. And so, why? Because there wouldn't be such an inducement to overutilize. And the fact that we say, what is the inducement if an organization has taken a capitated contract or offered a group of patients for a preset fee to take care of things, whatever is needed? What's the inducement, to overutilize or underutilize? If I've agreed for $1 and patient per month to do all the necessary cataract operations for that group of patients. You think I'll be doing a lot of cataract operations? No. It costs me money to do cataract operations. I have to hire people to help me. Right? I make my money by not doing stuff. By decreasing utilization. And so there was a time when it was considered very appropriate for even to try to get this risk down to the actual renderer of care to make the utilization inducement on the negative side. We drew a toggle pretty close to the beginning of the course where we said fee for service, and we said capitation. Like charging everyone a premium up front. We said fee for service increases utilization, capitation decreases utilization. Maybe fee for service increases utilization beyond what's reasonable. It seemed that a capitated contract decreased utilization beyond what was reasonable. Is there a way to combine the two methods of payment to come out, not too hot and not too cold, just right? Is there a way? Thanks for trying this. I offered to you that that boutique medical care had that potential, because what boutique medical care could do is, if the fee for service were low enough just to reimburse the physician for the cost, then the capitated payment, which is paid by the patient to enter the practice each year, whatever that cost would be, could be just that balance. The capitated fee paid by the patient, fee for service paid at a neutral rate, or even slightly less than the cost of the service by the insurance company, might make a system that was self-regulatory. But in any event, no one other than the promise of that, no one's really been able to find the mix of capitated payment and fee-for-service that is self-regulatory, that brings about reasonable behavior. Very difficult. But that's the story. Capitated payments on the level of the renderer of care, unless the renderer of care is a very big organization, organized either integrated either vertically or horizontally, it doesn't work. It fell out of use to ask the individual practitioner to essentially insure the insurance company. It just didn't work. Even if it decreased utilization, it just was a thing that lasted maybe 5 years, and it fell out of favor. But large organizations of renderers of care can assume some risk and do assume some risk. So this is some of this is discussed starting on page 953 about the organizations of care and what they mean. I'm going to skip to antitrust and then we'll get back to fraud and abuse. Antitrust is discussed on page 1095 and the following pages, but I didn't ask you to read that because you had enough to read. And I will summarize it and show you how it fits in with what we just discussed about organizations and integration of organizations. First of all, there is federal antitrust legislation been around for a long time. The Sherman Antitrust Act, the Clayton Act, Federal Trade Commission Act, all look to prevent monopolies, prevent unfair competition. And it did things like, early on, like say to medical societies, you know that the rule you have that no physician can have a sign on the office bigger than this and only the name on it? Well, that's restrained trade. You know that thing about physicians not advertising? So that all went by the wayside in the 70s. But it came to work against physicians when physicians were negotiating for fees. That physicians couldn't talk to each other really about what fees to charge. So Blue Cross Blue Shield said if Medicare said they were reducing their fees, the physicians got together and said, we're not going to accept those fees. We're going to go on strike. Well, hey, you're non-employees. You can't go on strike. You don't work for anybody. You're independent practitioners, generally speaking. Yeah, if you're an intern or resident in a hospital and you work for the hospital, you can go on, join a union, go on strike. But the majority of people negotiating for fees with government organizations and insurance companies, the majority of doctors were independent practitioners. And although the number of court suits that said, oh, but we're the equivalent of employees, we're just agents, really just agents of these insurance companies. We have no freedom of action. All those claims were rejected. Physicians in your offices, you are not employees. If a bunch of physicians got together and actually had common ownership in a PC, then the PC, of course, could bargain as a unit for the physicians involved, but the physician had to be part of that. They had to have either employment agreements with the PC or ownerships and partnerships, but there had to be an entity that was doing the bargaining, and the physicians as a group had to be part of that entity, an integral part of that entity. They had to be that entity. Now, at the same time, there was this little thing called the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which did the same thing for insurance companies under federal antitrust laws that the Savings Clause later did under the ERISA regulation, the ERISA Savings Clause. It said that Nothing in the antitrust shall apply to insurance companies that are regulated by the state. Insurance companies wanted to be regulated by the state. they were heavily regulated by the states, but as most regulated industries, eventually the regulatee becomes very influential to the regulator. And so the state's interest in insurance was more protecting the company against bankruptcy than in protecting the interests of the insured. And the most important thing about insurance law was, insurance company, you have to charge enough so that you're solvent. We don't want insurance companies coming in here and charging so little that we'll have to bail them out, or people will get left holding the bag. Insurance companies, unlike physicians, are not subject to federal antitrust regulation. And so there got to be an unlevel playing field, that physicians could not get together and bargain, and insurance companies, and managed care companies coming out with contracts, say that no, as a group, the medical society says, no, our doctors are just not going to take that. You're going to have to give us more. Or, physician gave you, said, no, we're not going to deal with that insurance company. They pay little. You have to do it on your own. You couldn't let it be known, or you couldn't talk to anyone, other private practitioners. No conservative rule action. How does that play into what we were talking about integrated systems? Well, there got to be a need to level the playing field. One way to level the playing field was to become big yourself. To have 100 doctors in an integrated system. Try to become so big that the insurance company would have to somehow deal with you a little better than my insurance company. And there became an exception to antitrust anyway. If you weren't really integrated, even if it was just an independent practice association, that independent practice association could talk for you as a group to insurance companies, provided that as the independent practice association was willing to assume risk. There got to be an exception to that because, it was really important for managed care companies to use this idea of capitation, of sharing the risk with the render of care. So, look, if they're willing to assume risk, if this organization is willing to assume risk, we'll assume that they're not bargaining for the physicians for undue advantage, that they're just taking the risk away from the insurance company. It's a strange thing. It didn't exactly make sense. But an integrated system could bargain for a physician presence, provided that there was risk sharing. And as it turned out, the bigness of some of these groups turned out to be a disadvantage in bargaining with the insurance company. And what do big groups have? They have big expenses. And although the individual practitioner had no clout, once a big group took on a managed care contract involving a lot of patients, made investments in shared equipment and whatever, sometimes a larger group was more vulnerable than a small group or an individual practitioner. I couldn't resist giving you some just a few articles for today, but one of them says, Boston Globe examines discrepancy in Massachusetts hospital insurance reimbursement payments. And what it says is that Partners Healthcare
has become so dominant in Boston as an integrated delivery system. The partners of doctors. According to the Globe, no company has thrived more or has more impact on the cost of medicine in Massachusetts than Partners Healthcare, which in 1994 was established to fight back against what its founders saw as the stinginess and lopsided power of insurance companies. Partners was developed as a collaboration between two of the state's most well-known hospitals, Brigham and Women's Hospital and Massachusetts General Hospital, and became what some call the 800-pound gorilla of Massachusetts healthcare, able to bend insurers to its will. They did it. They got big enough and prominent enough and had such a good reputation that when they say, insurance company, this is the contract that you're going to give us, that's what the insurance company does. However, while Partners prospers, 24 Massachusetts hospitals are losing money. And many of these hospitals would be profitable if they had even a fraction of Partners' contract class. Massachusetts General and Brigham, on average, receive payments that are 30% higher than other not the state hospitals, according to data obtained by the Globe. Partner CFO said, "We are willing to take the risk of challenging payers. Hey, if you are never willing to challenge them, of course they're going to jam it down your throat. But they're big. They really are big, and they have a stellar reputation. The growing dominance of Partners and Children's Hospital for Pediatricians is a microcosm of the national trend in the last 15 years as government has increasingly allowed the market to decide what healthcare will be available at what price. During that period, hundreds of unprofitable hospitals closed, while many others emerged to gain more negotiating power with insurers, which by the mid-1990s were aggressively denying claims and shortening hospital stays to hold costs down. Economists say that the clout of merged healthcare systems contributed to the significant increase in medical inflation in the 1990s, and healthcare specialists agree that the price run-up did not lead to a similar improvement in quality." End of kind of a perfect case to show. Managed care had a lot of clout. Doctors started organizing to integrated delivery systems to answer that because they couldn't answer it individually due to antitrust laws. But it's really only recently, they say 1990s, but that's the real cloud of Partners is really is just coming to be in the last 5, 6, 7 years. It really is, but it's steamrolling along that. Pendulum swings one way and it swings the other. There's no question that managed care as a concept, and managed care organizations and insurance companies have lost a lot of the clout and a lot of acquiescence from society that they had initially in the 80s. Okay, so when we come back, which should do, it's 10 after now, but by 20 after, I will go over fraud and abuse, and we'll do some of these. We'll do some of these. The rest of the articles. Okay, so take your break, and we'll see you in 10 minutes. If anyone wants to schedule a time to see me about the paper, you can schedule it now. My book is open.
Okay. cold.
Yeah, that's what I'm just going to say.
Thank you.
I didn't realize that it was. Your whole thing was single space.
No, it's
The recycled attendance sheet?
Yeah.
Fraud and abuse. When I gave this, when this was the only course I gave, I paid a lot of attention to fraud and abuse issues because it does really impinge upon the doctor-patient relationship. It's one of the statutes that has criminal penalties for physicians. And, but now that I give Medicare and Medicaid law, I pay much more attention to it in that course. And so I don't really concentrate on it at all in this course, but except to mention it for the next 10 minutes and give you a broad overview, because you have to know it. And it does sometimes impinge upon your practice as an attorney as well, in ways that you might not suspect unless someone actually told you. So, for those of you who are not going to get to take my Medicare and Medicaid course, and also for those of you who might be interested in view it as an appetizer, I have given you a sheet as a template today, and it's the last sheet on today's handout, which is what I give out Medicare and Medicaid law. explaining fraud and abuse. Now, if you have, if you overcharge your managed care company, if you charge them for, if you upcode, meaning charge them for a procedure that normally is considered removal of a pimple, but you charge them for an operation to remove a growth instead, and they, of course, in your contract have a right to review your charts, and if they find that you, managed care company finds that you've done that, and you say, well, you know, it's just a matter of interpretation. You call it a pimple, I call it a growth, you know. And I'm just presenting the facts in the light most favorable to my practice. That becomes a contract. Unless it's, you know, a gross, gross thing where someone is billing for things that just were never done, the managed care company could go to the state and say to the state, you better prosecute this doctor for fraud, but the state will, it almost never happens. Never happens. Most of the things that are considered fraud and abuse under Medicare and Medicaid and other government-sponsored programs under managed care or private company are just contract disputes. Managed care company has a lot of clout. They say, well, yes, doc, you call it a neoplasm surgery, well, we know it's a pimple. And so we're not going to pay for that. As a matter of fact, we'll just deduct it from the next payment that we owe you. And what we get, we usually owe you plenty of stuff. We don't pay so much. So that's the distinction. The government, the Medicare and Medicaid, has this big stick. This very, very big stick. Huh? You do that to us, and that's fraud. And there are fines that we can fine you. Big fines. $5,000 a pop. Every time you do such a thing, and maybe you did it on 100 patients or 1,000 patients. Maybe you were supposed to charge us this one thing, you charged us 10 cents too much. Maybe you didn't write it down in the chart, so you didn't document it. We're not going to pay for it. It's fraud. Use. And you know what? We can send you to jail for this stuff. Why? Going to the idea that the government money is kind of sacred. Going into that a lot in Medicare. Of course, why have we given the government the power to act toward providers in that way, that, you know, as we said, government as a provider, as a payer for medical care, and as a regulator of medical care, sometimes get that role intertwined and confused. So government always could say, doctor, practice without a license, you know, go to jail, or, you know, many other things that the regulatory police power, the state can always have plenty of power over the practice of medicine. But when it became the payer also, and then used the police power to enforce its position as a payer, that you could say was confusion of roles, overlapping roles. And, you know, that those diagrams I gave you the first day showed something. But there are reasons. Public money may be sacred money. The government realizes that it itself is not so able to control expenses or to look over suppliers the way that a private enterprise can. So government may be vulnerable and need this big stick. Whatever. Big stick. And so there are statutes that say these are things, doc, you can do and can't do. These are things that you cannot do. You can't bill for services that you didn't deliver. Services not actually performed, and if you didn't write it down, You didn't do it. Failure to document.
Because how are we going to know that you did it
if you didn't write it down? Overcharging for services delivered. Medicare, Medicaid has a fee schedule. Charging Medicare or Medicaid more than charges for other patients. Medicare and Medicaid are supposed to be the you're supposed to provide Medicare and Medicaid the lowest price, except for managed care contracts. Upcoding, charging for a higher level of service than delivered. The pimple versus the tumor. Failure to collect coinsurance and deductibles. You'd think, hey, that's a nice doc, right? That's a nice doc. You say, oh, I know you're supposed to pay me 20%, but the government's paying 80%. Forget it, go home. No. Nice doc?
Fraud and abuse. Why? Because the doc is not actually charging you what the doc says he was charging. It's supposed to collect the 20%. Otherwise, you'd only be collecting 20% of the lower fee. I mean, 80% of the lower fee.
Does that apply if they charge the government for that 20%,
or
does that apply across the board? Like, if they only essentially take the 80% and just let the
20%
go.
Fraud and abuse.
So fraud and abuse.
But on that form, I said, I charge $100. But Doc, you didn't charge $100. You charged $80.
Oh.
Right?
Or failure to collect, you know, the deductible. Double billing, receiving payment from Medicare or Medicaid, and even partially from another source, including the patient, for the same service. But you can do concierge care, provided that the contract says that the fee is for something that's not covered by Medicaid. You know, little cubby holes, hair slipping. Newsletter. Can't be for something that's covered. For services not medically necessary. Doc, how come you did an x-ray every day? You know, for what? You know, that's not necessary. False diagnosis. False diagnosis happen a lot more than you think. Patient comes to visit the ophthalmologist. Hi, what are you here for?
Oh, nothing, you know, it's my routine visit.
Oh, okay. Dr. knows
Medicare doesn't pay for routine preventive care. You need a diagnosis.
Does the exam. Doesn't find anything. Says to the patient,
you don't have to.
You've never had anything wrong with your eyes?
No, I'm just here, you know, I'm supposed to come.
Well, don't they ever get itchy or burning or teary or something? Oh, yeah, you know, I mean, in the wind and stuff, you know. Yeah, all red, teary, burn.
Eye irritation, especially in the wind. Diagnosis. Irritative conjunctivitis, now we get reimbursed.
So, I don't think anyone has ever been called on that, but it can occur in innocuous ways, and there can be liability for that. But, you know, what's a false diagnosis? Is impending myocardial infarction. An EKG. But it really, you know, there was no reason to call it an impending myocardial infarction. There was some chest pain. Upgrading service or upgrading diagnoses are still often fraudulent. Worthless service. Quality so poor as to render the service totally useless. You had a case that came in Mikes versus Strauss. You know, radiologist was fired. The radiologist was fired and reported that the other doctor saying
you know, they're not, their radiology equipment is so poor that they're not delivering a reasonable service. That's my court said, not fraud and abuse. The service was not worthless. We don't go into the quality of service. It has to be a worthless service to not be a reimbursement. It was, even though the quality was. The topic says false claims. Key Tom action available. Sometimes these judgments for false billing, false claims, can be huge. It's millions and millions of dollars, especially for a hospital. Hospital billing procedures that don't follow the letter that all kinds of situations where hospitals can bill for services and unbundle, and it's supposed to be an operation, everything goes with it, bill for the operation, the operating room, then it unbundle, bill for other things that should have been included. So someone working in the billing office, having special knowledge, can sue in the place of the government under called key Tom action and get a cut of the action. Sometimes really big bucks. Sometimes millions and millions of dollars. Doctors have to worry that, you know, a disgruntled employee will start an action, have to actually start a suit in the name of the government, not just tell the government. And maybe the possibly the Keycom action has a beneficial effect, but it could be very worrisome. So that's false claims. Billing for things at rates didn't do or shouldn't have been done. Anti-kickback is a whole other story. The idea is, and sometimes it's hard for our attorneys to understand, that if I, the physician, refer someone to a neurologist, and the neurologist says, hey, Weintraub, thanks for that patient, here's $200, that's a kickback. Because, you know, in the practice of law, that's accepted. The practice of law, you were supposed to stay involved. If you get a referral, you're supposed to stay involved for that referral fee. You're supposed to be a given thing. I don't know that there is, very often is, but referral fees are generally accepted. In law, they are a big no-no in medical practice. And some referral fees are kind of hidden. They're hidden in that, you know, Weintraub, if you come and if you send me all your neurology patients, you can use the office in my building and I'll only charge you a little bit. That's a kickback. Anything, advantage that a physician gets for the referral of a Medicare or Medicaid patient is considered a unfair advantage that will eventually cost the government money, because the notion is that neurologist fee, customary fee, will reflect the fact that he had to get the kickback or whatsoever. So if I accept that deal from the neurologist is liable for offering the deal, and I am liable for accepting it or giving it, receiving it or giving it. How do lawyers get liable under these circumstances? If as an attorney you advise someone, hey, this sounds like a great deal, Weintraub, I would take that deal, you know, I mean, you're getting a real good deal on that rent. And let's draw up a contract to make sure that the neurologist does actually take care of it. And yeah, of course, we'll put in a contract that you'll send them all your patients. But if you don't say that, just say, yeah, let's sign that lease for $7 a month. And yeah, I'll write that lease out for you or for the neurologist may both be. You are part of a conspiracy to commit fraud, and attorneys can get hooked in on this and get fined themselves and have gotten fined when the schemes have become large, especially when they involve large organizations. Paul, when your client's problem becomes your own, hey, you say, they can't do that to me because it's the attorney-client privilege, and my client is not going to say anything about what I advise them. Well, don't care. Your client will rat. The client will rat. Yeah, he told me to do it. Why? Because enforcement of these statutes are hit and miss. They're not often enforced, and they're not enforced up to the letter of the law. Doc, you owe us, on this basis, you owe us $2 million. You know, $5,000, and somebody, $25,000 for every patient that you refer to that neurologist. And other theories of recovery. But you're going to cooperate with us, aren't you? And no question that the Inspector General will go much easier. People will seem to be cooperating. Instead of that $1 million, you know, we're willing to settle this thing for about $25,000, but you got to cooperate. So, this is discretion of enforcement along a big spectrum that will make physicians say, cooperate. One of the indices of cooperation is, not when it's your lawyer. So you have to be very careful not to tell the physician that you can do something that, or a healthcare system, or to do something that involves the spectra of kickbacks, and some of the schemes that are set up could be quite elaborate. Or saying, gee, you know, I don't see why you can't charge a waiting room fee, something like that. You know, it doesn't say that the waiting room is included in the Medicare fee, but yes, it is. So you can be very liable for fraud abuse. Okay, we have a little time left. I say a little time because I'm expecting one of the staff to come in pretty soon. You know that. Change the semester back to paper evaluations of the professor rather than online, because the school found out that online, if it weren't done in paper while you're sitting here, that online the response rate was very low. So it's been returned to that. And so in a few minutes, when Joyce Cox comes in, hands you out the things. She's here now. Let me see if she wants to come in yet, or whether she wants. Got a couple more minutes. When she comes in, I'll stop.
So we are through with the substance of the course now. And all that's left is going over some of the articles which are redundant. Is from the article I gave you on the 4th. It's headed up with a review of the 28th. Supreme Court hears opening arguments in Wyeth v. Levine. He was heard on November 3rd. It will be decided sometime earlier this year. You should keep your eye on it. Wyeth made the argument that the FDA is really good at figuring out the risk-benefit ratio of a drug, and therefore they shouldn't be second-guessed by a bunch of jurors sitting on a state court. But the the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee was investigating the FDA and came across some high-ranking career officers, I mean, not political appointees, in the FDA that said, you know, when the government was arguing this case on the behalf of Wyeth, that the Solicitor General of the United States was arguing on behalf of Wyeth, submitted a brief on behalf of Wyeth that said that we're good at this, that, you know, maybe the politicos involved in FDA think that way, but we high-ranking civilian employees of FDA objected to all of that and objected to a lot of the wording that was put in the executive rules for the last 3 years. And so Levine wanted this information to be added to the court documents, even after they had heard it. And so they managed to get it in. They managed to get it in a ruling called Logic. If you look at the document, it said that they sought to have the testimony of these FDA officials lodged in the documents from the justice. I never heard that word before, of lodging documents after the fact. Okay? Health insurers push physicians to prescribe generic drugs. Here's a wrong statement. Last year, the American Medical Association classified incentives as kickbacks and warned that physicians who accept rewards for prescribing generic drugs could face criminal and civil liability under federal statutes. They weren't getting the money from the from the drug companies. That would be a kickback. They were just getting it from health insurers under managed care contracts. No fraud and abuse in that situation. That was wrong. Two employer groups filed friend of the court brief saying that Healthy San Francisco program violates ERISA. All these local and state initiatives saying, employer, you have to pay, you have to provide coverage or pay a fine or something like that. It's like the Walmart case in Maryland, and if challenged, could be overturned as that law was preempted by ERISA. And that's still ongoing. Massachusetts, largest insurer to require adoption of e-prescribing for physicians. That's information technology, but that could take hold. Physician, we know you don't want to spend all your day entering your patient history, physical, and your treatment plan in a computer, but how about just putting your prescriptions on a computer? That's probably an efficient use of your time. And will save a lot of errors in the pharmacy. And so I think most states, that will be the first required IT. Senator Grassley questions AARP about lack of catastrophic coverage in health plans. This is a recurrent theme of the course that I mentioned about 3 or 4 times today, that the plans being offered, like the one in Florida and some of the ones in Massachusetts, tend to be reimbursement plans rather than insurance plans because they don't cover catastrophic illness. They cover going to the doctor, going to for a hospital visit. Your coverage in Hofstra is that way also. And so you should really scrutinize the article I gave you today that says, hey, you know, the government will start looking into the certain colleges' role in getting kinds of kickbacks for student loans. Maybe the same thing is occurring in colleges, they name Columbia for one, for recommending or requiring that students enroll in a certain health plan. And the plans were inadequate. So the fact that we're moving towards more towards reimbursement than insurance towards is maybe cosmetic and it can be a problem. Here's another Los Angeles Times examines medical tourism. Requiring or encouraging people to go out of the country to get health care in Mexico or in Korea, South Korea, India, and China is trying to get into that as well. Health care among industries that seems best able to endure economic downturn. It's an article. You know, I do a little soft shoe about this one. Hey, you know, it's not really true that a dollar spent on health care is terrible for the economy. It's stimulating for the economy like anything else, and especially if it stays here, right? And lo and behold, in this downturn, healthcare seems to be a stabilizing force. 16% of the economy? Maybe tomorrow it'll be considered 20% of the economy because the economy shrunk. But healthcare is perking along. I gave you an article showing that displaced auto workers are finding jobs in healthcare. Don't accept the basic building block that will go bankrupt if we spend too much on healthcare. That building block is made of sand, and maybe one of the reasons contributing to the fact that we have a dysfunctional healthcare system. U.S. must reform health system to remain competitive in the world, Gingrich says. We spend too much money on healthcare. We're going down the tubes competitively. Newt Gingrich has said that. So it must be true. Medical necessity. Crestor can reduce risks for cardiovascular events in patients with high levels of protein, of C-reactive protein, and indication of inflammation. Even if the cholesterol is normal. Is this preventative care? You know, someone has high cholesterol, taking the drug supposedly to lower the cholesterol. The diagnosis is hypercholesterolemia. You take the drug to lower the cholesterol. You're preventing heart attacks. Preventative treatment, but it's considered treatment. You know, it's preventative, but it's considered treatment because there's a diagnosis that you're aiming something at. Here, these are patients who don't have high cholesterol, giving them drugs to lower their cholesterol. They don't have high cholesterol. They have some other indices. This is really preventative treatment. There's no diagnosis, really. Something new. This hit big this week. A lot of articles about it. A lot of articles saying, oh, this is great. Everyone should be on, you know, all these millions of people now should be on Crestor or similar drugs. So you can do it says right here that it would take 550,000 dollars to save one life. And is that a quality? We should do that, right? Saving a life, like giving someone a good life for how many extra years they would have had from the time they would have died. That's just not, a quality is not saving a life. A quality is $500,000 per, you know, good life year. There's probably a lot more than one quality for every life saved. So it says that on that basis alone, the basis that would cost $550,000 to save one life, that sounds like a good deal. Of course, the problem is this was an industry-sponsored study. Right, and the problem was that not only that, but the person the head investigator has a vested interest in the test for C-reactive protein, so it's probably a conflicted study. And we're not sure if it's trustworthy or not. Or one of the things that did show is that if you do take Crestor, in these situations, you seem to have a more greater likelihood of developing diabetes. Okay, so two articles. Medical imaging tests are overused, another medical necessity article. Okay. So we are essentially caught up. I will I'll see if Joyce will come in now so that you know. That clock is still connected. Okay, so I'll see you next week. You can always call me in my office if you have any. Yeah, I'll just come back after you're done.
Going down this, right? The CRN class is. Done. I have a gazillion more of these to do. And just take two piles. Thank you. No, like doing a class, yeah, a very unique class.
Or just after class next week? I think after class next week is fine because, you know, because you have to come all the way in. You know, so I haven't been trying to do this.
And if I need another appointment after that,
fine.
That's fine.
And if we can't handle it over the phone, then come in.
Okay. Tell me again what you.
Yeah, it's. My office is 563-516-463-5773. You can also call me on my cell phone, which is
516-241-0831.
Okay.
Oh, wow, there's a phone.
Oh, this is recording.
Oh.